Okay, tonight's learning should be dedicated to Nishmas Basya Roiza Bas Meir. So this evening we are doing something that we started last year, and I hope not to do it next year. I don't want to make this a new pattern, a new habit, but in the past we spent some time before Tisha B'Av going over those Gemaras in Gittin that are discussing the Churban Beis HaMikdash and different Churbanos in Klal Yisrael's history to give us a little bit of a taste, to get us in the mood to get ready for Tisha B'Av. We're ready now in the 9 days. Shavuot Shechalboi, maybe not this year, but we're already supposed to be getting into the mindset of preparing for the Churban Beis HaMikdash and trying to get into the feeling, into the mode, and into the proper mindset for the Churban. So last year, we started the Gemara Daf Nun Hei Amud Beis, and we got through to the top of Nun Vav Amud Aleph, but what we need to know for tonight is we just need to remind ourselves of the very famous story, very famous comment said in the Gemara on Gittin Daf Nun Hei Amud Beis. Why exactly are the sugyas of Churban Beis HaMikdash even in Maseches Gittin? I spoke about that last year. You're going to have to go listen online to hear the answer to that question. But we left off last year. We had the famous Gemara with the story of Kamtza Ubar Kamtza Churv Yerushalayim. The Gemara makes a very, very important statement. The Gemara says because of a Jew named Kamtza and another Jew named Bar Kamtza, because of these two individuals, Churv Yerushalayim was destroyed. And just to familiarize everyone with that story, the Gemara tells us the story was there was a man who had a very good friend named Kamtza, and there was Bar Kamtza, the two people. One guy was his arch enemy, and one guy was his best friend. And somehow, when the invitations went out for the big Suda, the invitation accidentally invited his arch enemy instead of his best friend. The Baal HaSuda comes down, and he basically makes a royal scene, because his arch enemy is at the meal, and his arch enemy gets terribly embarrassed because he's thrown out of the party. He then goes and tattles and rats out the Jewish people to the Roman government. This is during Bayis Sheni, just to keep us in throughout Tisha B'Av, we're always, especially in the Kinnis, we're always jumping back from Bayis Rishon to Bayis Sheni, just to put it into perspective. We have, and in the Kinnis, it's even more so, because in the Kinnis, we jump back to Bayis Rishon, Bayis Sheni, Yirmiyah, then we have 1240, and then we have the Crusades, and then we have the Holocaust. So there's a lot of jumping around through historical backgrounds. So it's always kedai just to get all the facts straight to know what we're looking at. So in these Gemaras, we're focusing on predominantly Bayis Sheni, even though about a blot in, we'll jump to Bayis Rishon. But for the first, what's the gear for probably tonight, is we're focusing on Bayis Sheni. Bayis Sheni, the Jewish people, lived in Eretz Yisrael under the rule of the Romans. You have to remember, we were, from the times of the Hashmonaim, we were in charge of Eretz Yisrael after the Hanukkah story. But as time went on and the Jewish people were not living the way they should, so the Roman government, Rome, who was the massive, large powerhouse, of that time, they were just conquering more and more territory. Ultimately, they came to conquer Eretz Yisrael, and there was a fight. We will talk about it maybe tonight, if not for sure, B'li Nedra at the Kinnis. We're going to talk about all the Roman Jewish wars that took place leading up to Churban Beis HaMikdash, and we'll talk about tonight, hopefully, how the Jewish people had to make a decision to either allow Rome to continue to dominate us and to restrict many of our religious freedoms and other freedoms, or are we going to fight back? And that was the big discussion of Churban Bayis Sheni, was did we make the right decision by fighting back? Or maybe we should have placated the Romans, not fought back, and they would have left us alone, they would have left the Beis HaMikdash. We wouldn't be in control, we wouldn't be like during the times of the Hashmonaim, but at least we'd have a Beis HaMikdash. And that's a big discussion that we'll have to get to this evening. But the backdrop is relevant because the Jews were always living in fear of the Romans. The Romans were technically in control of Eretz Yisrael, and any time the Jews did something wrong, there was always a threat that Rome would find out and Rome would punish them. So this fellow who was morbidly insulted by the fact that the rabbis were all at the meal, and no one said anything, how he was terribly insulted, he went and he ran and tattled to the Roman government. He told the Roman government the Jewish people are rebelling, and he had a whole story, how he proved it, what was the basis, and that's where we're going to pick up this evening. So we're picking up, how exactly did this cause the Roman government to get so upset at us? So if we start over here, middle of the Gemara, we're holding now, I'm going to read the Gemara out loud, but if you have a Gemara in front of you, it is definitely helpful. We're holding now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines in from the wide lines in the Gemara. So what basically happened was before this is that he told, it's interesting, he told He told Rome that the Jews are rebelling, and Rome's response was, "How do you know? Prove it to me." And he said, "Because if you will try to offer a carbon to the Jewish people, they won't accept it." So the Gemara tells us that he went and he made a mum in the carbon, and therefore the Jewish people were presented with a dilemma: should they bring the carbon b'mum, or should they deal with the wrath of the Roman army? They decided to do nothing. They did not bring the carbon, and therefore Rome was quite upset at this time with the Jewish people. So that's the backdrop that we need to know, that Rome is mad at the Jewish people because the Jewish people are rebelling because we didn't want to offer their carbonos. And the only reason why we didn't want to offer their carbonos was because it had a mum in it, and this fellow put the mum in it. So Bar Kamtza, who is the villain in the story, because Bar Kamtza was the reason for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, Bar Kamtza was very mad and very angry and very frustrated. So what he did was, he basically got the Jewish people in trouble with Rome. Says the Gemara, Shadr Ilehon L'Neiron Kesar. They sent for Neiron Kesar. So there's a shayla, how to read, who sent what? So many before Shemlun, Shadr means that Bar Kamtza sent a telegram, he sent a message that ended up bringing Neron Caesar, was one of the Caesars of Rome, down to the Jewish community. Kikaasi, when he came and he was en route to come to attack the Jewish people, so he did something very strange. Shad Gira L'Mizrach, he sent an arrow into the east. Very strange thing. He's coming with his army, he's the Caesar, very powerful, very strong, an army man, and the first thing he does is he shoots an arrow to the east. So, we'll see in a second why exactly he does this, but the question which we'll see the Mefarshim ask is, why an arrow? What's special about an arrow? So, the Ben Yoyada explains that an arrow is Meramez to Lashon Hara. And, again, this is obviously very drushy, but the Caesar wanted to know, have the Jewish people, and we know Bayisheni was, the problem was Lashon Hara. Bayisheni was Sinas Chinam. And therefore he wanted to see, will the arrow have power? Will he be able to overtake the Jewish people? Because the Jewish people were lacking in this idea of Lashon Hara. So what happens? He sends an arrow eastwards. Asa nafal b'Yerushalayim. It fell in the city of Yerushalayim. Lamariv, he sent an arrow to the west. Asa nafal b'Yerushalayim. It also fell into Yerushalayim. La'arba baruchas Hashemayim asa nafal b'Yerushalayim. So he sent an arrow in all directions, and the arrow always fell in Yerushalayim. So this was a sign from heaven to Neron Kesar that he's right for what he's doing. He's just for what he's doing. He therefore took this as a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the fact that all his arrows were falling in Yerushalayim, like the Ben Yoyada explained, that the arrow signified the fact that Bnei Yisrael was sinning with Lashon Hara, which an arrow and Lashon Hara is a connection. He took this as a sign from Shemayim that he is justified and validated in going and attacking the Jewish people. So the Mashal over here has a very basic question, that the fact that the arrow fell in the east is not a chiddush if they were coming eastward. And if that's the direction you're coming and you shoot an arrow, it's not a chiddush that the arrow fell in that direction. That's what we call normal occurrences. So what was the chiddush? So the Mashal explains that he shot this arrow when he was very far away from Yerushalayim. Al piderech hateva, the arrow shouldn't have reached that far. But when he saw the arrow, even though it was shot from so many miles away from Yerushalayim, that was a sign to him that he was doing the proper thing, and Hashem wanted him to destroy Yerushalayim. The Anath Yosef gives a different answer. He says because Niron was choishish that even though perhaps the Jewish people deserve to be destroyed, maybe Hashem will make some miracle. He'll make some miracle that even though his arrow is projected to go into Yerushalayim, Hashem will make a miracle that a wind will come out of nowhere and knock it away. And when he saw no such miracle took place, and he saw that Hashem is allowing Teva to take its course, he saw that as a sign that he therefore should then get involved and go and attack the Jewish people. The Ben Yoda also explained that the reason why he shot an arrow to the Mizrach was because he wanted to see, the Mizrach represents Torah, because we know the Shemesh rises in the Mizrach, and the Jewish people are like the Torah. So, and the Shemesh is remes to the Torah. So he wanted to see, will the Torah protect the Jewish people? And that's something we're going to talk about tonight as well, as whether or not the Zuchus HaTorah, the Zuchus HaLiman HaTorah that he had during Bayi Sheni, was that enough to protect the Jewish people from the ultimate Chorban? He gives another pshat to Ben Yoyada, that maybe the role of the Mizrach, the East, was because Moshe Rabbeinu is compared to the Shemesh. We know Rashi tells us in Chumash that Moshe Rabbeinu was the sun and Yeshua is the Levana. So again, so Neron Kesar was testing the water to see whether or not Moshe Rabbeinu will be able to come in and protect the Bnei Yisrael or not. So nonetheless, he sends these arrows out, and he likes what he sees. He sees that Either, according to the Marsha, even though he shot from a very far distance, the arrow still fell. Or according to the Anav Yosef, he saw that Hashem didn't get involved with making a miracle. He took this all as a sign that he is supposed to do what he does. So all of a sudden, while he's getting ready to come into Yerushalayim, he meets a small child. And he says to him, "Psukli pesukech." So tell me a pasuk. So then Rav Yosef explains what he was trying to get out of this kid was that he just saw from Hashem, from the whole shtick with the arrows, that Hashem wants him to attack Bnei Israel. Hashem is consenting to this. He wanted to see maybe not only is Hashem consenting, but maybe he'll be rewarded for killing Bnei Israel. Maybe Hashem will reward him for bringing down the Beis HaMikdash. So he stopped this kid and asked him, tell me a pasuk. Amalei, the kid said to him, V'nasati yestik masiba adoyim biyad ami Yisrael. I will place my nekama, my revenge in Edoim, which usually means Rome, Edom, which is what we were talking about. Biyar Ami Yisrael, through the Jewish people. Amar, so the Caesar said, Kutcha Brichu Boy Lichruvi Besa. Hashem wants to destroy his house. Uboy Lichfuri Yadein, he wants to do it through me. He said to himself, 1 second, the kid told me that Hashem is going to take revenge against those who hurt Klai Yisrael. So why am I going to be the guinea pig? I'm going to be the guy that goes and destroys Klai Yisrael, and then Hashem is going to come back and get and be a fatayinad on me. No deal. Says the Gemara, Arak v'ozel v'igayer. He ran away and he became a Jew. Now, stop for a second and think about this. This would be lahavdil, someone converting to Judaism in 1941 in Germany. Wasn't exactly a good time to be a Jew living in Eretz Yisrael under Roman control at this point. And not only did that, he was a Caesar. He was one of the leaders. But he saw the honesty, he saw truth, and he gave it all up. Ozal, Orek, Arak v'Ozel, he ran away, v'Igayer, and he became Jewish. Says the Gemara, v'Nafek Minei, and who came from him? Says the Gemara, v'Nafek Minei, Rav Meir. Rav Meir became a descendant of his. There is a little bit of a shaila exactly on how that worked. If you look in the Rambam, in his commentary, in his Akdoma Tiara Chazoka, the Rambam says that Rav Meir's father was a Ger Tzedek. So this is Kipshuta, that this general, this Caesar ran, and he converted, and he had a baby, and that baby was Rav Meir. Other people say, no, it wasn't exactly a father-son, it might have been a descendant, like a grandfather-grandson, but definitely Rav Meir Shtam, Rav Meir came from Gerim, and since Rav Meir came from Gerim, he came from this Caesar. If you look in, it's quoted in many of the historical books, according to the Roman version, he committed suicide. So some people say, yeah, because they don't know what happened to him. He ran away. They figured he ran away and committed suicide, but we know he ran away and he converted to Judaism. Now, there's a fundamental question over here on this Gemara, which we can ask from the beginning of Judaism, Ad Hayom Hazeh. And the question that the Mefarshim point out is, if Taka HaKadosh Baruch Hu pre-decided Me'ezet tam shiyah that Klal Yisrael needs to deserve a korban, so why taka should any specific country get in trouble for it? If Hashem decided that Klal Yisrael needed to get kicked out of Eretz Yisrael and Bais Rishon, so why is Bavel blamed? Bavel is merely a shliach of Hashem. And why is Rome blamed? And why are the Nazis blamed? And why are the Arabs blamed? We can go on and on and on forever. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided for whatever reason we or a Jew or anyone needs to specifically have a punishment, so why are you blaming the messenger? They are just following the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, since they're just following the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why taka should they be held accountable? What's pshat in the pasuk? V'nasati yisnik masi be'edim. Why would Hashem take the cup against Edom? Edom was following Hashem's will. Hashem said, you're the shliach to go kill the Jewish people. The Jewish people need to be kicked out of Eretz Yisrael. They sinned, they did aveiros, and you're merely my messenger. So it's a very, very fair question. So why should it be this way? The truth is, this kasha comes up when we talk about the Pesach story. In the Pesach story, we all know, it says in the Chumash, that there was a lot of pain that was given to the Mitzrayim. A lot of pain and suffering the Mitzrayim befell after giving us a lot of pain and suffering. And the Rishonim there all have a kasha. Why did Hashem punish Mitzrayim for doing the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? If at the Brisbane Absarim Hashem decided that Klal Yisrael needs to suffer in Mitzrayim, so Mitzrayim is merely a pawn in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's great, great plan of life. So why are they held accountable? And again, you can ask this really at every tzara. If for whatever reason Hashem decided that European Jewry had to be annihilated, and we definitely don't understand why, and we don't even attempt to understand why, and this again, when we come to Tisha B'Av, this is another time to talk about. We don't talk about it so much throughout the year, but we talk about the tragedy of European Jewry. Lithuanian Jewry was mamish annihilated. Annihilated, Lithuanian Jewry got the biggest brunt of the Holocaust. Something like 3% of Lithuanian Jews survived the Holocaust. It was terrible. But if for whatever reason Hashem had a gzeirah min hashamayim, the European Jewry had to suffer, so maybe the Germans and the Nazis and the Ukrainians and the Poles and all the other terrible people that joined, they were just following Ratzon Hashem. So the Rambam discusses this question, Hilchos Tshuva Perek Vav Halacha Hey, he's talking about it with Mitzrayim. And the Rambam says, Enachanami, Klal Yisrael needed to suffer in the land of Mitzrayim, but each Mitzri didn't have to be the one to do it. Meaning, there was a gzeirah on Bnei Yisrael had to suffer beyond a Mitzri, but I didn't have to be that guy. Could have been my neighbor. And each Mitzri who'd made a conscious decision to cause pain to Bnei Yisrael, for that reason they are punished. The Ramban gives a different teretz. The Ramban says in Bereishis, Perek Tezvav, Pasuk Yud Gimel, the Ramban says, no, if they were chosen to cause pain to Bnei Yisrael by Hashem, you can't hold them accountable. So Taina the Ramban, so why we have Mitzrayim in trouble? Says the Ramban, because they went too far. Enachanami, the Jewish people had to suffer in Mitzrayim because of Gzeira from Brisbane Absarim, but the Mitzrayim upped it too high. It was supposed to be a level 5, they made it a level 10. And I guess you could say that for all our Charbonis, perhaps according to this Ramban. Maybe we needed to suffer Bayis Rishon under the Babylonians, we needed to suffer Bayis Sheni under Rome, and we needed to suffer under the Crusades, and we needed to suffer under, you name it. But who said it had to be as brutal as they made it? And culture came in the Holocaust. The brutality that existed at that time was uncanny to any other time in history, and hopefully should never be repeated. So clearly there is such a madrig when you go too far. Maybe Klal Yisrael needs it, and we all understand this as parents sometimes, you know. You have to give a punishment, but then you say something, but I don't need to give the kid the most extreme punishment. The kid doesn't have to be grounded to, you know, till his chasana. He needs to get punished, but there's got to be limits. So therefore says the Ramban that all the Chorbonites and all those nations that were chosen by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be the vehicle to punish Klal Yisrael, they all went beyond what they should have, and therefore that's why they're held accountable. The Ravid, there's two different versions, and the Ravid is quoted in different places, but at least in one place, the Ravid gives a different answer. The answer that I'm sure many of you are familiar with is that the reason why Hashem chose these nations must have been for a reason. Meaning, why did Hashem chose Mitzrayim to be the place to inflict Klal Yisrael? Why did Hashem chose Babel as a nation? It must be that they aren't exactly the greatest of people. Therefore, says the Ravid, due to their past experiences, for whatever they've done in the past, that's why they were chosen to be the people, to be the Shliach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore they are going to get punished as well. The Mefarshim ask a question, why was Nairon Kesar rewarded with Rav Meir coming out from him? Why was that the Schus? Why wasn't the Schus that he was rewarded, that he became a millionaire? The Schus was he became whatever. Why was the Schus? Because he saw the response of the child and he said, I don't want to be used as I don't want to be blamed for this, and he ran away. He was zeichet to have Rav Meir. We know Rav Meir was a great Tana, don't get me wrong. But why Rav Meir from all rewards? So the Ben Yehuda gives a very nice pshat. The Ben Yehuda explains, because clearly this Nairon was impressed by miracles. He saw miracles and he said, I see something's going on over here. Right? When the arrows all went a funny direction, he said to himself, there's something going on over here. Hashem has a cheshbon. Therefore, Rav Meir Balhanes, he was zeichet to have a descendant who was Rav Meir, who was a Balhanes. He was able to perform miracles because his father or grandfather looked at things in life and said, Taka, this is abnormal. This is a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Eretz Tzvi, the Tzvi Froimer, and especially at this time of the year, talk about Yidden and Gedolim that we lost over the Churban. So Reb Tzvi Froimer, we'll talk a little bit about him. We've spoken about him in other settings, but it's kedai to go through it again, especially before Tisha B'Av. Reb Tzvi Froimer has a pshat in this Gemara, why he was zeichet to Reb Meir. But before we get to his pshat, it's kedai to talk a little bit about his life. Reb Tzvi Froimer was born in 1884. He learned by the Avnei Nezer. He was a Talmud by the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer had a yeshiva. Avnei Nezer was a Rebbe. He was a Rav and he was a Rosh Yeshiva. And the Tzvi Froimer learned in his yeshiva. And when the Avnei Nezer died in 1910, the Avnei Nezer's famous son, who we all know today as the Shem Shmuel, the Sacha Tshava, so a year after his father's passing, he opened the yeshiva to, in memory, or I guess, continue his father's legacy. But the Shem Shmuel was busy being the Rebbe of Sacha Tshava, so he appointed the Tzvi Froimer to be the Rosh Yeshiva of the Avnei Nezer Yeshiva. And he was Rosh Yeshiva until World War I began, And when World War One began, that was the end of the, basically the entire Sachet Shava community was destroyed. Again, not Nazi version, but just because of war. And he had to start traveling. And that's when he traveled and he became a Rav of a town called Klozhigov, which is why many people refer to him as the Klozhigov Rebbe. But he was only Rav in Klozhigov for a very short time. I don't really think that's the right title to give to Reb Tzvi Freymer. But what's perhaps more famous about Reb Tzvi Freymer was in 1934, right after the passing of Rav Meir Shapiro, he was picked as the Rosh Yeshiva for Chachmei Lublin. He took over the Yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin. Now, just to put into perspective, to get into Chachmei Lublin, you had to memorize, I believe, 300 Blat Gemara. That's to be a Talmud in the Yeshiva. So let alone what it means to be a Rosh Yeshiva. Just to think about that on a level for a second. To be a Talmud, you have to have 300 blood. And we know some very famous Talmidim that went to Lublin, Shmuel Vosner, Pinchas Hirschsprung. For those Canadians that are listening, one of the great Gedolim of not so long ago. His son actually lives here in my neighborhood. I got a chance to speak to him. Pinchas Hirschsprung was a Talmud of the Lublin Yeshiva. So just to be a Talmud of the Lublin Yeshiva, you have to, I think, know 300 blood by heart. So you can imagine what Reb Tzvi Freymer knew. Reb Tzvi Freymer in his youth wrote a sefer. He wrote a couple of sermons in his youth. He wrote a sefer called Siach Asadeh. He wrote that very early in 1912. And then when he was already much older, 1938, he wrote a more famous sefer called Eretz Tzvi, which is often quoted, and that's where many of his Torah is from. He wrote an Achumish, he wrote a Shas and Tshuva sefer. Very, very fascinating stuff. In 1938, at one of the Knesia for the Sima Shas, He decided with a new invention, which I believe is still popular today. He came up with Mishnayis Yoimi, a Mishnah a day. Instead of a blot a day, he did a Mishnah a day. And I think that was a very successful initiative. I think it's still very much alive today. In 1939, when the Nazis invaded Poland, so he went to Warsaw and he found himself in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was one of the Gedolim in the Warsaw Ghetto during the uprising. Right, there's a lot of the history and discussion and misinformation about what exactly took place in the Warsaw Ghetto, but there were Gedolim that were alive during the uprising. One of them was Menachem Zemba, who supposedly was one of the people running for the position of taking over Lublin. And it's interesting, they say that Menachem Zemba was one of the contestants to take over Rosh Yeshiva, and the Tzvi Freymer wasn't even on the list. And yet the Anhalas HaYeshiva chose him to be the Rosh Yeshiva. But in any case, so Tzvi Freymer was in the ghetto, and there's stories about how he survived in the ghetto. He was working to make shoes in the ghetto. And after the uprising, which again is a shoes for a different time, but one of the chesroinus, or the downside of the uprising, was it caused for basically a smoke out of the ghetto and a complete emptying out of the ghetto. And Tzvi Freymer was taken to Madanik, and he was killed in the gas chambers of Madanik. Reports say that when he went to the gas chambers, he went dancing and singing with a great simcha and b'mikadish shem shemayim through dying al kiddush Hashem. But again, Reb Tzvi Freymer, the Klozhigov, is another one of our korbanos that we lost in the Holocaust. He was murdered in Madanik in 1942, 1943, shortly a few weeks after the uprising of the Warsaw Ghetto. If I'm not mistaken, he has nephews who survived the war. I heard there is a Freymer wing somewhere in YU. I believe that is named for him as well. But his Torah continues. We have the Eretz Tzvi we learn, and his Shas and Tshuvas are quoted a lot. His Svarim HaChumash is very nice, but he was murdered in Madanik by the Nazis. In any case, so what was his pshat? So Tzvi Freymer explained beautifully. He says that, what was Rav Meir? He says that the Beis HaMikdash lit up the world. The destruction of the Beis HaMikdash caused a darkness to the world. So when this Nairon Kesar decided not to be the one to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, not to be the one to bring darkness to the light, to the world, in essence, he was Zoyche to bring light to the world. Who was light onto the world? Rav Meir. The whole word Meir means to light up the world. And therefore, since he chose not to darken the world with the Churban, but rather he decided to give light to the world by not being the one to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, he was then Zoyche to be the one to produce a Rav Meir who very much lit up the world. Okay, so now we have a problem. Now the Romans had a problem. They had no general to attack the Jewish people. So the Gemara continues, Shadre Ilor Lespinus Kesar. They sent Vespasian. Okay, Vespasian we know a lot about. We'll talk about him in the Gemara. They sent Vespasian to be the new general in charge. Also, he comes tsar oleh talas shoni. He laid siege around the walls of Yerushalayim for 3 years. Havibuhu tilsa atiri. There were at that time in Yerushalayim three very wealthy men. One was Nakhtiman ben Gurion, one was ben Kalba Savua, and one was ben Tzitzis Akesis. Three Jews that were very wealthy living in Yerushalayim at this time. Then the Gemara explains how they all get these very unique names. Nakhtiman ben Gurion, Shenektaloi Chama Bavuroi. He's referring to the Gemara in Tainis. The Gemara in Tainis tells us that the Jewish people needed to borrow money and they had to make up a deal that it's going to be paid back when they got water, and they're going to pay it back by a certain time, and they didn't have water yet. So he basically had the sun come back out and not set yet in order so it could still be daytime to keep their end of the deal. So that's Nakhdim and Goyen. We're talking about very chashuv people, clearly. Ben Kalba Savua, how do you get a name Ben Kalba Savua? Kalba Savua means a dog of satiation. Says the Gemara, "Shekol anichnas lebeisik yeshu rov kikel." If anyone that came into his house hungry as a dog, yotze kishu sevei, he left full and satiated. So you clearly see he was a big bal chesed. Ben tzitzis hakeses, who's the last fellow, Ben tzitzis hakeses, shahisa tzitzos in yigreres al gabi ksosis. His tzitzis used to drag on cushions. He used to have people carrying cushions, so his tzitzis doesn't drag on the ground. His seat used to be amidst the big hotshots in Rome. So we're talking about big knackers, as we'd say today. Big hotshots, financially well-connected, well-hooked up. And Mufarshim pointed out a nice chat over here that, you know, you see he wasn't embarrassed to dress Jewish in front of people. According to the first chat, he wore his tzitzis out. They dangled on kosis, which means he wasn't embarrassed to wear a Jewish malbush when he went out. He didn't hide his Jewish look when he went out. He was proud of his Jewish look. He was proud of the way he looked as a Jew. He wasn't hiding it, even though perhaps, according to Yekad Amri, he went the months Gedolei Romi. He went with the most highest ranking people at that time, the Gedolei Romi, and he wasn't embarrassed of his dress code. He felt proud to be a Jew. He dressed like a Jew, and he wasn't embarrassed. Again, Mefarshim point out that these three people were very special people. They were willing to accept upon themselves, we'll see in a second, they were big bali chesed. They were big bali chesed, they were big bali tztaka, they were cared, they concerned for the people. So the Gemara says what happened. They decided that they're going to support Klal Yisrael. Because again, there was a siege, there was a blockage around Yerushalayim, nothing coming in, nothing coming out. So if there's nothing coming in, nothing coming out, you're going to starve. So how are you going to live? So these three Ashirim, these three wealthy people decided they're going to self-support the entire city of Yerushalayim. So the Gemara tells us what happened. One of them said, I'll support them with wheat and barley. I'll support them with wine and salt, umishcha and oil. I'll support them with wood. And each one, I guess, whatever industry they worked in, they were able to support and give back to the people to support them. The Gemara says, "V'shivchu Rabbanu deTzivi." The Rabbanu praised the wood. The deTzivi, the Rav Chisda called Kaldi Avi Masal the Shami, because Rav Chisda used to give over all his keys to his assistant Barmi deTzivi, except for the key to the wood chest, wherever they kept the wood. That was very important, very chashuv. So giving up wood is a big deal. To fill up a warehouse of wheat, you need 60 akalba de tzivi. Akalba de tzivi havelu. Where to go? Akalba de chiti boy shitin. Akalba de tzivi havelu. You need to have more. Havelun lemezen. I forgot how you read this. Akalba de chiti boy shitin. Akalba de tzivi havelu. Boy shitin. Akalba de tzivi. I think Mar is saying over that you need more. To fill up a house of wood. Okay, so wood is more chashuv. Now this is what we need. Says the Gemara, it's unbelievable. Just think about this from an economical standpoint. Says the Gemara, Havilu lemezen esrim v'chad shata. These three could have continued supporting everyone for 21 years. For 21 years. Can you imagine that? 21 years they could have solely supported the people of Yerushalayim. But there was a problem. Havi Bahu Hani Biraini. So now we have to talk a little bit about the history of what was taking place during this time. During Bayesheni, when we were under the control of the Romans, there were different groups and segments in Klal Yisrael. The Harbo was known as the Biraini. The Biraini were what we'd call today warmongers. They were hot-headed. Rashi calls them Amaratzim and Rekim. They weren't exactly the Talmid Chachamim. They were hotheads, and they wanted a fight, and they wanted perhaps independence, and they were looking to go to fight. They were always ready to fight Rome, battle them, don't give in, be tough. That was the Beroinim. Then we had the Tzedukim, who didn't believe in Torah Shabbat Peh. They were a Hal Betzara. And then we had what's called the Perushim. The Perushim were what we call ourselves. The Orthodox movement were the Perushim. And the Perushim's outlook on Rome was not the same as the Beroinim. The Perushim's outlook on Rome was much more, let's not go to war. And we'll see why exactly. But this was a big interpersonal conflict between the Beroinim and the Perushim. The Beroinim were warmongers. They wanted to go to war. Let's fight. We can't sit idly. We can't let Rome take us over. They were very, very pro-war. While the Perushim, the Orthodox, were much more, we have to know our place. We're not in control. We have to be machni ourselves. A very different attitude. So the Gemara says, Hani, Havibuhu, Hani Beroinim. There were amidst them those Beroinim. Amru Luhu Rabbanan. The Rabbanan said, Nefik v'navit shloma ba'adayu. The Rabbanan said, let's go make peace with the Romans. Let's appease the Romans. Let's make peace. Let's not fight them. Maybe if we make peace, they'll leave us alone. Says the Gemara, Lo Yishav Kinu. The Beroinim would not hear of it. The Beroinim would not hear of any possibility of making peace with the Romans. No, we're going to fight them till the end. Says the Gemara. So what happened next? So the Gemara says, Vayter, what happened? So before that, just to point out, the Mefarshim point out, why was there a tsar of 3 years? So they say because, in Judaism, 3 is a big number. We have the 3 Avos. We use a lot with Kain Levi Yisrael. So the Romans wanted to see if that 3 years go by, that's already a sign that this is they're okay with attacking the Jewish people. And therefore, after 3 years was when things really have. That's how long they kept it going for. So what happened? So the Beroinim told the Perushim, nope. We're not letting you go out and make peace with them. Says the Gemara, what about going to war? Amar luhu nefid v'navid karva badayu. So let's go to war. Amar luhu rabbona loy mistayeya milsa. We will not win. The Rabbanan told the Beroinim we're not going to win. So what happened, says the Gemara? Komu kaloini lahanu amavri dechite v'sari v'havi kafno. Says the Gemara, so the Beroinim took matters into their own hands. The Beroinim said, if you guys are not going to go to war on your own, I'll make you go to war. What did he do? They burned down the Chitim Esayim. They burned down the warehouses that had the food to sustain the people for 21 years. And now the people have no choice. They're going to have to go to war because the siege is going to kill them. So therefore, says the Gemara, these Beroinim decided that they so much wanted to go to war against the Romans, that even though the Rabbanan didn't let them, they forced the Rabbanan to have to go to war by burning down all their food. So now they're going to starve to death, so they have to go to war. So the Ben Yehuda has a gewaldic piece over here. It's unbelievable. He explains, what was the svar of the Beroinim, and what was the svar of the Talmidei Chacham? The Beroinim were convinced that if they go to war, they're going to win. The Rabbanan said, if we go to war, we're going to lose. So I would have thought Pashup Shad is the Beroinim were hotheads. They were, they liked to fight. They weren't from Talmidei Chachamim. They liked the battle. Pride, Jewish pride they were fighting for. But the Ben Yehuda says much nicer. The Ben Yehuda says, no. These Beroinim were thought that they're going to win in war b'schus ha-Torah. As we know that during Bayi Sheni, there was a lot of Torah being learned. There was an abundance of Liman ha-Torah. And therefore, they thought that b'schus ha-Torah, they'll be saved. So why did the Perushim argue on that? So the Ben Yehuda explains that the Perushim said, Einach Hanami, you're right. That normally Torah has a kayach to protect us, and we have a principle called Akol Kol Yaakov. We are done. We survive through Akol, through Torah and Tefillah. But said the Ben Yehuda, but Chazal knew that there was something wrong with our Torah. It was mixed with Lashon Hara. Since we had Sinas Chinam, Lashon Hara, we had all these bad interpersonal relationships and dealings that stared, that ruined our abilities to be able to be successful in war. So even though, says the Ben Yehuda, Avada, we had a lot of Torah during Bayi Sheni, but that would not be enough to help us succeed in the war because of all of the Lashon Hara and the bad speech and the negativity that we had, and therefore Chazal knew not to go to war. But they had no choice now because the Beroinim burnt down the entire storehouses. Now they're going to starve to death, so therefore they were forced to go into war. Then the Gemara tells us a story over here about a woman called, says the Gemara, let's just read it one more time. So what happened? So Amul Rabbanu Lamis Tayy Milsa Kamu Kelanuhu Lahanu Amavri Dechita Besar. They went and they burned down all the storage houses of the wheaten. And the Mefarshim point out they don't talk about the storage houses of the wood, but okay. The Have Kafna, and therefore there was a hunger. Says the Gemara, Marsa Bas Baisis. There was a woman named Marsa Bas Baisis Asirosad Yerushalayim Havye. She was one of the wealthy women of Yerushalayim. Now there's a Gemara. In, I believe it's Yevamos, the Gemara talks about a woman named Marsa who was married to Rebbe Shua ben Gamla. And that took place during Yanai HaMelech, which was way before Chorban Beis HaMikdash. So the first of all, try to figure out, is this the same woman? Is it not the same woman? Against the discussion, is this the same woman? But we have this woman, Marsa Bas Baisis. So the Gemara tells us she was rich. So what happened, says the Gemara, Shadrasa L'Shlucha, this is all during the siege, when there was no food coming in and out of Yerushalayim. So Shadrasa L'Shlucha, she sent a messenger. For Amrale, she said to him, Zel Aisi La Samida. Go on and buy me Samida. What's Samida? So they translate it as fine flour. Ad Ozel is Dabin, when he went to the market, it was already sold. Also, Amale Smida Leka Chirusik. Okay, there's no Smida, but there's Chirusa. What's Chirusa? The court is white bread. Okay, not as good, but manageable. So Amrale, she said, Zel Aisi La, go buy it. Ad Ozel is Dabin. By the time he got back to the store, it was gone already. For Amar Lo, and he says to her, Chirusa like a gushkara ikka. We have gushkara. Gushkara is coarse bread, hard bread, not as gishmak as the other two. So Amarle, she said, Zelaisli, go buy it for me. Ad Ozel is Davin. By the time he got back to the market, this is why you need to have a cell phone. This way, if you have a cell phone, you can call from the market, you can ask her what she wants. But this was a pre-cell phone, so she had to go back to the house, ask her what she wants, and by the time he went back to the market, everything was gone. So what happened? They have wheat of barley, which I guess is a lower level. Go buy it for me. The ozel is dabin and was gone already. Says the Gemara, have a shlifa misani. She was barefooted. Amra, she said, epok v'ichsi. She says, you know what? Forget you. You're a lousy messenger. I'm going to go out myself to see what's cooking in the street. I can find something to eat. So what happened was she stepped in some form of animal manure and she couldn't handle. She was such a mufunekes type of lady. She was an ashir b'Yerushalayim. She never stepped in, you know, simple people step in animal manure. She was an aristocrat. She was royalty. So she got so grossed out, so to say, from stepping in it, she died. Okay. Now, what's the purpose of this story? So the Mefarshim point out the purpose of the story is to contrast her to the other three people that we mentioned. She was rich and she was selfish. She only cared about herself. What am I going to eat? What am I going to do? What's best for me? The other three Ashirim that we have in the Gemara, Kalba Savu and Akiva Ben Gurion, these people said, how can I help the Jewish people? The Torah is telling us, the Gemara is telling us, look at the different attitudes. You have people that are Baruch Hashem well off and financially stable, and their attitude is, I don't care, I'm not sharing a dime with Achenu B'nai Yisrael. It's my money, I worked hard for it, I'm not giving it to you. Then you have people who Baruch Hashem are financially stable, and all they want to do is help other people. That they're always looking for avenues, ways, building, marbits, spreading. These are the two different outlooks on life, and the Gemara is contrasting these three Ashirim, these three great people, to this one very awful woman who was stingy and did not share her money. The Gemara has another version of what happened with this woman. Says the Gemara, what's the other version? Ikad Amri, some people say it was a different story. Says the Gemara, what's the Ikad Amri? Says the Gemara, Ikad de Amri, Gregeris de Reb Tzadik Achla. She stepped on, or she ate, Achla, she ate the Gregeris of Reb Tzadik. Visnasya, and she got grossed, Umes, and she died. What does it mean, the Gregeris of Reb Tzadik? Reb Tzadik Yosef Arboin Shnin Betanisa. Reb Tzadik used to fast 40 years prior to Churban Beis HaMikdash, Loilecher of Yerushalayim. So Yerushalayim should not be destroyed. Why 40 years? So the Mefarshim explained, because the Gemara tells us that 40 years before the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the doors of the Heichal used to open up on their own, as a sign to say, we're no longer in control. So Reb Tzadik already got the hint, he already got the message, he got the memo, already 40 years before the Churban, he was fasting. And he wasn't just stopped fasting, says the Gemara. He was intense fasting. He was so emaciated that when he'd eat something, you'd see it from the outside. We can imagine this because we have Nebuch, sadly, we have pictures of Holocaust survivors. You see how skinny they are. You see their bones. Clearly, you can count how many bones they have in them. Says the Gemara, Reb Tzadik was so thin, he was so emaciated, that when the food would go down his throat and into his stomach, you can see it from the outside. Says the Gemara, V'chiyavi Bari, when he was healthy, Maisila Gregaris, they used to give him a Gregaris, Mayitz Mashuhu. All he would do was suck out the drink, V'shadilhu, and he would throw it out. So Mefarshim point out, why was this the way that Marsa died? Because it's the same idea. Reb Tzadok fasted 40 years for Klal Yisrael. He cared so much about the Jewish people, and this woman could care less about the Jewish people. And therefore, says the Gemara, that's the contrast. That's why she died on the same fig that Reb Tzadok lived off of. Because Reb Tzadok lived for Klal Yisrael. He put himself through pain. He fasted 40 years for Klal Yisrael's benefit. And this Marissa couldn't care less about Klal Yisrael, even though she was financially stable. The Mefarshim have a kasha. They point out, how is it exactly possible that he fasted for 40 years? He has to eat on Shabbos. He has to eat on Pesach. So how did he deal with all that? So I think the answer that they give is that he started off fasting regularly, and then because he became so accustomed to fasting, his body needed him to fast. He couldn't eat on Pesach because his body couldn't handle it. He needed to go back to a mamish, a no-food diet. But in any case, that's unbelievable, Mesiras Nefesh, Reb Tzadok, for what he did for Klal Yisrael. Says the Gemara at the end of the story, this is amazing. Says the Gemara, Kiyavah Konicha Nafsha, when she was dying, she took all her money, this wealthy Marsa, all the big bucks that she had, and she's dying now from eating the fig of Reb Tzadok. She said, all this money, Amri Haile my boyli, what is it worth? Silver in the streets they're going to throw. She came to the realization that what is all this money going to do? If she would have used her money to help Klal Yisrael, that money would have had nitzchias. But because she kept that money stingily in her own house, and now she's dying, money can't bring her back. There's nothing she could do now. She's stuck. She's going to die a very painful death. One of the great Gedolim who suffered miserably in the Holocaust, but Baruch Hashem survived, was Rabbi Yisrael Zev Gussman. I like to talk a lot about Rabbi Gussman. I find him to be a fascinating gadol. Many people know him. Many people knew him. Many people learned by him. Many people spoke to him. And he was one of the previous generation gedolim. And we know that Rabbi Gussman was the Talmud of Rabbi Shimon. He learned in the same yeshiva I learned in. Maybe that's why I feel a connection to Rabbi Gussman. He learned in Sha'ar Torah Grodno in Grodno. I learned in that yeshiva when it was in Queens, and it is in Queens. But he was there at 11 years old. He was a Talmud by Reb Shimon when he was 11 years old. He was a Chavrusa with the Chaim Shmuel Levis at night. They used to learn Yushalmi from like 12 to 4 or 5 a.m. every night. And then they learned Kachim. And at the age of 22, when he got engaged to his wife was the daughter of Rav Meir Basin. Rav Meir Basin was one of the Rabbanim in the Vilna community. Rabbi Soloveitchik said about Rav Meir Basin, because Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he was in Berlin, this Rav Meir Basin was in Berlin for medical purposes, and they somehow talked on learning, and Rabbi Soloveitchik was amazed by him. Now you have to know, for Rabbi Soloveitchik to be amazed by anyone is a very big deal, but Rabbi Soloveitchik was very much nespa'al from this Rav Meir Basin. This Rav Meir Basin died. He died. And the deal was that if Gussman was going to take him over as the dayan, he's going to take him over as the dayan. The only problem was if Gussman was at the age of 22. At the age of 22, he wasn't yet ready to be a rabbi. He was never trained to be a rabbi. He was learning what we call today lumdus. He was learning the yeshiva style of lumdus. He wasn't ready to be a rabbinic figure. He wasn't ready to, definitely not to fill his shver's position as one of the most chashuva dayanim in one of the most chashuva towns in Europe, in the Vilna. The Yerushalayim of Vilna, it was a big deal. So the Chaim Moshe told him, you know Gemara? He says, yeah, I know Gemara. So he said, good, so now sit down, learn all the Beis Yosef, and I'll teach you, I'll show you how to be a Pesach. Now in order to get smicha, to be on the Bezdin with Reb Chaim Moshe, he had to know Shas and Shulchan Aruch by heart. So Reb Gussman, by the age of 22, memorized Shas and all of Shulchan Aruch. It's just an amazing thing to think about. In any case, in June of 1941, the Nazis invaded Vilna, and the first person the Nazis always came after were the Rabbonim. And since Rav Gusman was already one of the head Rabbonim in Vilna, again, Reb Chaim Moshe already passed. Reb Chaim Moshe died really before the Nazis invaded. Reb Chaim Moshe died while Vilna was still a safe haven, was still under the Russians. But Reb Chaim Moshe did not see the horrors of the war. His wife survived. His wife was alive for the onset. And Gusman spent a lot of time always trying to help Reb Chaim Moshe's Rebbetzin to help her as much as he can. I believe she perished in the Holocaust as well. So in 1941, Reb Gusman had to run away. And this is where Reb Gusman tells us about another great gadol who died in the Holocaust, which also a lot of people don't talk about. And this was the Macheshes. The Macheshes was also one of the great dayonim in Vilna. The Macheshes was Chanoi Chenoch Agis. He wrote a sefer which we quote sometimes in our Sunday morning shir, the Macheshes. The Macheshes was brutally, brutally murdered by the Nazis. And Reb Gusman was there to see it. He knew about it. He testified about it later. And Reb Gusman told us about that. That he was, again, another great gadol that's not talked so much about. In Holocaust, we already so far mentioned two great gadolim. Great, great European gadolim that we still learn their svarim out of Yom HaZeh. Last year, if you remember, we spoke a lot about Rabbi Chana Wasserman, who was also murdered by the Lithuanians in the war. And this year we're focusing on Tzvi Freimer and the Macheshes. But we all know, and this is where I'm coming to with the story, is when after Reb Gusman ran away from the original attack from the Nazis gathering the rabbis, then the Nazis rounded up all of the Jews of Vilna. And when he was online with another fellow who Reb Gusman knew, the fellow said, "I'm very nervous because before we came to this point, the Nazis told us we have to give up all our jewelry and all our money before we come to the station here to be transported to different places, and I didn't listen, and I have all this money on me, and I'm nervous that one of the Nazis are going to pat me down, and they're going to see that I'm carrying money, and they're going to kill me." So Rav Gusman said, "Okay, I'm going to help you. Give me all the money." And Rav Gusman, along the steps that they were taking to get to the area where the Nazis were telling them where to go, Rav Gusman was dropping all the money along the way. And Rav Gusman used to teach this mesechta, this blat, his talmidim. He said that's pshat in the pasuk. This fellow had all this money, and the money was worth nothing. He had to throw it all on the ground because if the Nazis would have caught him with this money, the Nazis would have killed him. And if Gusman said that shot in this pasuk over here, the pasuk that we said, that kasboim bachutzos yashlichu, silver you have to throw away, it's not worth anything, you can't do anything with the money. The money's useless, it has no value. He said that was what took place during the war. The postscript was with Gusman, his wife, and his daughter survived the Holocaust. They were partisans hiding out in the forest, so Gusman learned how to shoot. But one of the tragedies is that Rav Gusman lost his son. He had a son named Meir. His son was beaten brutally, basically while he held on to him, while the Nazis beat him, and he died in his own hands. And he tells the story horrifically, how his son died in his arms, and he buried him, and he took off his shoes, and he sold his shoes to get food for his wife and his daughter. And he said that he wasn't able to eat from that food. He couldn't stomach eating food that he used from his... This was the apple of his eye, his son Meir was his prized son, and he buried him. And I just saw this year something I never knew, that they one of his talmidim asked him later on, you know, his feelings post-war. He said, "There's not a day that goes by that I don't think and see and picture those shoes of my son Meir." It's a trauma that Holocaust survivors lived with forever. Hopefully we won't have a Tisha B'Av this year, but if we have to do Kinnis, I want to talk a little bit about it at the Kinnis when we talk about the Holocaust, the trauma that some of these Yidden lived with forever and ever, and what they saw in the Holocaust. So if Gusman told us Talmidim, that's Pshat in this pasuk over here, that money's not worth anything. During the Holocaust, just like during the times of the Romans, having money didn't help you, it didn't save you, it didn't protect you. The Gemara continues, the Gemara tells us now a new story. Tells the Gemara, Abba Sikra, there's a fellow named Abba Sikra. Who was Abba Sikra? Reish Biroin in Yerushalayim. He was the head Biroin. He was the head of this gang, the Biroinim, who we just said were real troublemakers. The Biroinim were not good people. The Biroinim were not the Perushim. They were not the Orthodox movement. They were the troublemakers. They were the ones who wanted to go to war. And who was the head of this party? A fellow named Abba Sikra. Who was Abba Sikra? Says the Gemara, Bar Achse de B'yechel Ben Zakkai. He was the nephew of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, just a little bit about his life. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the first 40 years of his life, he worked. He had a job. The next 40 years of his life he learned. In the last 40 years of his life he taught Torah. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was, at this point in history, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was basically like the Gadol Hadar. He was like the leading figure in Klal Yisrael during Chorban Beis HaMikdash and post Chorban Beis HaMikdash. But his nephew, his sister's son, was the Reish Bereini. So what do you see from this Gemara? You see from this Gemara that from very chashuv families, sometimes it doesn't always work out that way. Sadly, there were many Gedolim in Europe whose children were not from. Nebuch, they didn't stay from. It was a big Nisayan. It wasn't easy. There was a lot of different things pulling people to different things. There was communism, and there was Zionism, and socialism. There was a lot of isms in Europe. And a lot of B'nai Torah got swept up and caught up in these different moments. So here also, this head of the Bereinim was the nephew of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So the Gemara tells us a fascinating conversation. Says the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, we got to do something about this situation. We can't continue on with Yerushalayim being under siege like this. We got to do something. So what happened? Says the Gemara, Sholach Lei, he sent a message to his nephew, Tobitzino legabei oso. Let's talk in private. Obviously, we can't meet in public. We're arch enemies. You're the Bereini, I'm the Perushim. Let's have a private meeting, closed door meeting, to discuss the situation. Amalei, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his nephew, Ad emas avdisa hachi. How long are you going to do this? Because lisi le alma bekafni, you're going to kill us all with hunger. So he said back to him, Amalei, maya avid, what do you want me to do? Di amina luhumidi katloi. If I say anything to them, they're going to kill me. Now, we just got finished saying that he was the head of the Bereinim. But as we know so many times in so many movements and parties, sometimes the people who start the movement end up getting losing power, and then therefore at some point if they'd want to leave, they would be in threat. Lahavdil, there were many people who originally joined the Nazi party and were in the Nazi party, but when things got as gruesome and violent as they did, they wanted out of the party. But they basically said, you know, you know too much already, you're too involved, you can't leave the party. I don't think that was the majority of the SS officials. Most of them were ruthless thugs who enjoyed murdering Jews. But there were a few people who Taka said that they really didn't mean this much. But by the time they got caught up already, they you know, if they would have left, they would have been killed. So over here, he was saying that I want out, but they're going to kill me. So Amalei Chazi Li Takanta. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai says, I have an eitzah. The afik efshir chazir l'takanta l'didi, an option for me. The afik that I can get out of the siege efshir to have a teleport. Maybe if I can get out of Yerushalayim, maybe if I can get out of this siege that we're under, maybe I can figure out a way to save the situation. So amalei nokot nafshucha bekatsiri v'leisi kuli alma. So he basically is trying to come up with this whole plan to fake a death, make believe Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai died. If Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai died, the Bereinim will let the dead body come out of Yerushalayim, and he'll fake his own death. He'll come out on the other side. He'll be able to go. He'll be able to go out and speak to whoever he thinks he's going to speak to. So what happens? So so he basically said, "I want you to knock nafshecha b'ktiri. I want you to make it sound like that you're sick and you're shvach. Make believe you're sick. Let the word go out. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is sick. V'leisi kuliyamu v'leshay lebach." The icy meat is of Agnik Abach, and then take something smelly and put it under you, because the Bereinim really only wanted you to leave if your body started to decompose and smell. Let people say he's dead. And only let your students carry you. Don't let anyone else carry the bed. Basically, we can't let anyone carry the casket, because anyone who carries the casket is going to realize the casket is the kol ata, the inu yadur, the chaye kolil mimisa, right? We know something called dead weight. So therefore, if they're going to be able to carry a live man, they'll be able to tell the difference in weight between a dead body and a live body. It would be a dead giveaway, no pun intended. It would be a giveaway that he's not really dead. So they came up with this whole plan to figure out a way that they can fake Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's death, get him outside Yerushalayim. Once he's outside Yerushalayim, he'll somehow talk to the Romans to figure out some peacemaking. Because again, the Perushim wanted to make peace with the Romans. Says the Gemara, Aver Hachi, they did this. Nichtas bar Eliezer Mitzarecha, Reb Shua Mitzarecha. So Eliezer carried one side of the coffin, Reb Shua carried the other side of the coffin. Kimatu lepischa. When they got to the entrance to leave the city, Boile Mitkari. So the Bereinim were no fools. They wanted to make sure he's really dead. So they wanted to stick, you know, like a sword through the coffin to make sure he's really dead. So Amalahu Yoimu Rabbonon, the Kari Bohu, They're going to say, what? They're going to say, this is what you do to rabbis who die. You plunge knives through them. So they figure, okay, let's push the body. They're going to say, this is what you do to rabbis. Even the Baroinim had episode Madrega of how you're supposed to treat a rabbi. Fine. So finally they let them through. So Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Yechem and Zaki was able to fake his death. They didn't stick anything through the body. They didn't shake the body. The Baroinim gave in, and they were able to get Rabbi Yechem and Zaki to the other side. So what happens now? Rabbi Yechem and Zaki is on the other side. So what? Says the Gemara, Kimatu Hasam Amar Shlomo Alechem Malka, Shlomo Alechem Malka. So he meets Vespasian, and he tells Vespasian, Shalom Alecha, Shalom Alecha. He says, but Shalom Alecha Malka, he calls him king. So Vespasian says to him, Mechayav to Trek Tola. You mechuyiv misa twice. You have a double sentence. You have a double death sentence. Why? Obviously, the Mefarshim point out that there's no major idea to have, there's no such thing as double murder, right? You can't die twice. But he's saying that your statements cause you to be punished for two things you said. What are the two things? Says the Gemara, why? Chada de lav malka. First of all, I'm not a king. The kakaris le malka. You're calling me a king. That's meridim amalchus. I'm just a general. Vesu, and secondly, I malka. And if I'm taka king, ada idna mailo yosi legabe. So why haven't you shut up till now? Either, if you're saying I'm a king, it's not true because I'm not a king, and therefore you're Mariba Malchus back to whoever the king was back in Rome. And if I'm Taka king, so where have you been till now? You're Mariba Malchus. You haven't come visit me. You haven't come to show any interest. So Amalei, he answers back, on the Taina, that you're not a king. Says the Gemara, Ivra Malkat, you're going to be a king. You're destined to be a king. Why, says the Gemara? The Ilav Malka Ad Le Mimsri Yerushalayim Biyadecha. Because if you wouldn't be a king, there's no way Yerushalayim would fall in your hands. The Chassid says in the Pasuk, V'alavonan Ba'adir Yipol. The Levonan, with Adir, it will fall. Vein Adir El Melech. Adir means a Melech. The Chassid, V'ayah Adiroi Mimenu. Vein Levonan El Beis HaMikdash. And Levonan means a Beis HaMikdash. So it says the Levonan only will come down with Adir. It means only a Melech. Someone who has a status of a king of Rome, can bring down the Beit HaMikdash. Udika Amit, and now you have a taina on me. You have a taina. I have a kasha on me. So before we get to that. But Lamaisa, he wasn't the Melech yet. He wasn't the Melech yet. Why would you call him Melech? Hashema Asid. So Chatzkel Abramsky brings over this kasha from the altar from the Vardik. In fact, the altar from the Vardik, very good. Hashema Asid is going to be a Melech. Oh, but right now, he's not a Melech. So Chatzkel Abramsky brings a beautiful pshat from the altar. The altar explains because in Yoichem and Zaki's vision, he saw what Nevuah showed him, and since he saw Hashem Osed, he saw that Vespasian is going to be Melech. And in his mind, Vespasian is already Melech. He believes so strongly in the Nevuah that he had in his Kabbalah that he's going to be a Melech. So Kilu now he's already a Melech, even though technically, legally, he wasn't a Melech, but in his mind, he was already a Melech. Chatzkel Abramsky, we mentioned him also in the past, he suffered not under the Nazis, but he suffered under the Russians. Chatzkel Abramsky was a Rav in Russia, and when he tried to leave Russia, they basically threw him into Siberia for 5 years. He had a five-year term in Siberia. That's where he finished working on his Sefer Chazon Yechezkel. The first volume was written before they threw him into jail, but the rest of the Sefer, the completion of Chazon Yechezkel, was written when he was in Siberia. And when he came out of Siberia, just to ruin him even more, they shaved his beard. And when Rav Pinchas Teitz went to greet him when he was released in 1931, he had no idea where he was because he was expecting to see a rabbi with a big beard. But the Russians, just to be Russian, difficult, just to be Mavaza, Talmud Chacham, they shaved his beard and they made him go without a beard. He ended up moving to England, where he was the head of the Rabbonim in England, with Dayonim, and ultimately he moved to Eretz Yisrael. Again, another great Gadol who suffered. Again, these Gadolim, we sometimes don't appreciate their Torah. When we read their Torah, we don't realize how much went into what they wrote. we read a shtickle from Chazon Yechezkel, and we've quoted it many times in the Sunday morning shiur, but just to think about, he wrote this when he was in Siberia. In freezing cold Siberia, that evil, evil place, he wrote a sefer that we have today, and he smuggled it out on cigarette wrappers. It's unbelievable. The Mesiras Nefesh that these people did, and we're not talking about thousands of years ago. He died in the 1970s, I believe, not so long ago. These were great, great people that were moisen nefesh for Torah. Okay, so what happens next? So I really want to get I'm going to just skip a little bit because it's getting late and I want to get to a very important idea over here. The Gemara tells us I'm skipping because I'm really short on time. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is sitting there next to Vespasian, and Vespasian has one shoe on and one shoe off. And he wants to put one shoe on, and he can't get the other shoe on. And then he decides, you know, I'll just take the other shoe off and put on a different pair of shoes, and he can't get the other shoe off. And he's kind of having a panic attack. He's trying to figure out what's going on over here. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tells him, no, it's very normal. Since you became, because in the middle of this, they got the telegram that you're becoming the melech. So since you heard good news, so your bones start to swell, and that's why you can't fit into the other shoe, and you can't take the other shoe off. So he says, what do I do? So he says, well, have a person that you don't like walk in front of you, and that will make you angry, and that will cause the swelling to go down, and kachavi, it worked. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was very impressed. Vespasian was very impressed with this. And he says, you know what? I'm about to leave. But evil Titus, which we're not going to get to tonight, we'll talk about it, Blin Edra, the Kinnas, evil Titus is going to take me over. But before I leave, I'm going to give you three requests. Three, like a genie, right? Three wishes. So this is the famous Gemara. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for three things. What are the three things Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for? So the Gemara tells Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for, Tein li yavne v'chachomeho. Give me a place in Eretz Yisrael called Yavne where I can have the Talmid Chacham, where Torah will not be lost. I need a place for Torah to continue. That was one thing he asked for. He asked for the base Nasi not to be destroyed. And the last thing he asked for was for a doctor to help Reb Tzadik. And the Gemara says a very important pasuk. The Gemara says we have a pasuk in Yeshayah. Meishiv Chachomim Ochur V'daitam Yaskil. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes makes smart people make foolish decisions. And the Gemara says this about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could have asked for the Romans to stop bothering Klal Yisrael, to save the Beis HaMikdash, not to attack us. And the Gemara makes it sound like that this was somewhat of a mistake on Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's part. And the Gemara says back, no, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai figured that he's never going to get that request. That's not even on the bargaining table. And therefore he figured I'll shoot for something small. But the Gemara has this pasuk over here, Meishiv Chachomim Achur V'daitam Yaskil. So someone once asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, how could it be that throughout the beginning of the Holocaust, many Rabbonim suggested staying? Not all the Rabbonim, I'm talking about big Gedolim, suggested leaving. Many said stay. How could they have been so foolish to not see the writing on the wall? Now, I'll tell you what Rabbi Soloveitchik answered, but just from a historical standpoint, I find that question to be very troubling. Because if anyone would have, this is all, that question is a hindsight question. If anyone was living during that time, no one in a million, billion years would have ever have imagined what the Holocaust would have been. No one. So it's really not such a fair question, but Rabbi Soloveitchik answered this puzzle. Rabbi Soloveitchik answered that at times in the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not give the tzaddikim and the chachamim the das to make certain decisions because Hashem wants a certain outcome. Hashem didn't want Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asking for this. Hashem didn't want the Gedolim telling people to leave Europe. Hashem has a cheshbon, and for whatever reason, He tells people to make certain decisions. Now, the truth is, I think the more logical answer to that question is that people really didn't know. And I'll prove it to you. One of the great Gedolim that suffered through the Holocaust was the Svi D'Esh. The Svi D'Esh was Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg was a Talmud of Slobodka Yeshiva. He ended up towards the before the war, he was one of the great Rosh Yeshivas in the famed seminary, Hildesheimer Seminary. And we have letters that he wrote to the Nazi Party in 1933, where he basically endorsed the Nazi Party. And he felt that Nazism was the answer to socialism, to communism, really. I'm sorry, not socialism, to communism. And he basically said, and he wrote a letter to the party in 1933, basically saying that, no, we're not, you know, you keep on looking at us as this negative party, the Jewish party. We're not so bad. We really appreciate what you're doing, that you're squashing communism. And for many years leading up till, basically until Kristallnacht, he didn't think the Nazis were as bad as everyone else thought. To the point where, when there was a discussion about whether or not they should move the seminary to Eretz Yisrael, Reb Chaim Moshe said they shouldn't move it for different reasons. Chaim Moshe thought that the seminary doesn't belong in a place like Eretz Yisrael, but that's for a different time. One of the reasons historians believe that Rabbi Chiel Yaakov did not want to move the seminary to Eretz Yisrael is because he really didn't think in a million years it would ever be anything more than a little bit of a crazy rhetoric and life would settle down. The Yidden didn't know. The Pasha didn't know. No one anticipated. No one thought. No one imagined. But clearly in life, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has an idea of who's going to live and who's not going to live. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows who makes certain decisions, who makes other decisions. And we don't know. It's very easy to look back in hindsight and judge, but b'shas ma'isa, these things are very difficult. But l'ma'isa, the Gemara ends off, and we're going to have to end off here for tonight. Hopefully we won't have to learn this next year. But the Gemara ends off that Vespasian granted Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai these three wishes, and that's why we have Yavne. Yavne was a safe haven for Torah, and that's why Torah continued through the Chorban and post the Chorban and Baruch Hashem through all the many Chorbanos that Klal Yisrael suffered. And Belineda will talk about this if we have Tisha B'Av, we'll talk about the loss of Torah of the Holocaust. Forget, I don't mean Chas V'Shalom, not to focus on the light, but there was so much Torah that was lost in the Holocaust, so much Torah that was lost in World War I, so much Torah that was lost in the Gemara burning of 1240, so much Torah lost in the Crusades. But Baruch Hashem, Bechazdi Hashem, we have so much Torah still left today. We have Svarim, and we have Kailim, and Batei Midrashim, and online learning, and Shurim, Baruch Hashem. Amidst all the various Korbanos of Klal Yisrael, the Torah still continues. And Mr. Hashem, we should not have to experience a Tisha B'Av. We should be Zaycha this year. We still have a few days left to turn Tisha B'Av into a Moed, into a Yomtif, into a joyous Yomtif where we're going to be able to dance and sing, rejoice together, understand the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, understand why so much tragedy, so much pain and suffering. We should be zeichet together to greet Mashiach with the arrival and the great news of Mashiach. B'mehar b'yomeinu. Have a wonderful evening. Mitzvah Hashem, will be back next Tuesday night.